Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever in the world you are. Thank you. Thank you for joining us for Keeping It Real with James Valiant and Robert Nacer. James, how are you doing on this fine Wednesday?
Oh, quite well, sir. Things are just going swimmingly for me, and I hope they are for you as well.
They are. Had a big party, big picnic this weekend. I'm keeping it real and enjoying life on Earth. And James, you have given us some questions about that today. And we're jumping in a little more philosophically this week. A little more toward the end of the book, some of my favorite questions in Keeping It Real, the collection by Dr. Leonard Peikoff. So apropos of having had a particularly good weekend, I hope folks are going to join us in the chat. We want to see your questions. We want to see your comments. In fact, I'll say right at the outset here, I want to see them stand out. Hit that dollar sign. Make it into a super chat. We will read your question, your comment, and you will be supporting the Ayn Rand Center UK. Ayn Rand Center UK has been doing great work, and I'm especially excited to see the reality shows continue, The Daily Objective, all of the other programming. Mark Pellegrino, along with Jennifer and Jax, have been doing TV Talk. Great episode of that last week. You should be supporting the Ayn Rand Center UK. You probably already are, but just in case you're not, link at the top of the chat to become a member. Super chat link underneath the chat. Bring on those comments and those questions. James, you've picked some great questions this week. As I say, more philosophical, which is good. This gets to the heart of, well, what we're going to talk about today, what we're going to talk about later, too. Make sure you watch those Daily Objective and reality show episodes. Question number one, let me dive in. And I love this question, even though it might make you cock your head for a moment. If we are to decide our actions by reason and logic, man, I feel like we're taking a jump right to the reality show because I already know what those topics are. If we are to decide our actions by reason and logic, why do we have emotions? Leonard Peikoff was asked this question on his podcast back in September of 2012. And I'll read part of how he starts his answer. But James, I want to hear your thoughts on this. Leonard Peikoff says, first of all, what do you mean by why? Do you mean what purpose did God or nature have in mind? All you can ask is, what good are emotions? What are their functions? And there are a great many. Emotions are, as Ayn Rand has shown in great detail, automatized responses, adding up instantaneously all of the values you hold in a given situation, thereby applying your value judgments in a situation which there would not be time to do it if you just simply set it all intellectually. And then Dr. Peikoff gives the example. Well, someone came at you with a gun and there were no emotions, no fear. And you looked at him and said, well, yes, life is the standard and I am the purpose and man has right. By the time you got to the impropriety of force, you would be gone. But the fear tells you right away, well, this is a threat to your values. Unquote. I'll stop there. He goes on, but it's an interesting question because, James, don't we ask this a lot? Why do we have this? Why do we do that about metaphysical primaries?
Well, see, that's it. The why question is, I mean, that is human nature. And obviously, nature in itself is unconscious. It doesn't have purposes. It doesn't have conscious goals like human beings do. It doesn't even have animal awareness. It just is. And so when you ask why human beings have a certain faculty, why you ask why, for example, we have an appendix or why we have, you know, hair on the top of our heads, what you're asking is not a question that to use Aristotle's language, for which there's a final causation answer to, it was somebody's purpose and plan and goal. No, what we're asking, you could be asking, I suppose, a purely scientific question. How did it evolve? What conditions caused it to evolve to make it a more adaptive living species and so forth? That would be a purely scientific question. But if you're asking in a philosophical sense, why do we have them? Then you'd have to ask, what role do they actually play? What function do they play? Like my stomach or my eyes, what function do they play in me as an overall organism? That's the philosophically significant question. And I think the important thing on these questions we're going to have today is just that, the meaning of the terminology used, because sometimes terms can be used in an ambiguous way. And what philosophy really is there to help us do is to sort through distinctions, which sometimes our sloppy use of language doesn't get at. So I say, why do we have emotions? Well, Leonard goes on to give the really practical, important reasons why we have, just like why we have a stomach in that sense, to digest food. It's part of our biological survival mechanism that evolved in humans. Similarly, with the emotional, our emotional mechanism, it serves all kinds of vital functions in us as a living organism. But it's those kind of things that we just sort of have to take as givens as philosophers. There may be a good scientific explanation for it from the biologists and chemists or whatnot, but from a philosophical perspective, we take human nature as is.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out, because you might remember, you might be old enough to remember the old hippy dippy expression, why ask why? As if the very act of asking why is ridiculous and you just shouldn't worry about anything. But I love it, the idea that, well, when you ask why, what do you mean by why? Like, why do we have emotions? What is the cause? How did it come about by virtue of evolution? What is the purpose that they serve? So you're exactly right. It's not that the questions are bad. You've just got to know what you mean by those questions. And Leonard Peikoff does a great job of giving several answers to the way in which that could be a meaningful question. I want to jump to the end here, because this is a little different take. So this might throw some folks. And Leonard Peikoff says, they're all emotions. They're also, I may say, helpful as instantaneous reactions in judging people. Now, they're very tentative in that context. If you find someone you feel to be somebody you like, just by the chemistry, well, you could be 100% wrong. And I have been so wrong in liking people on that basis. But if you just follow the evidence, well, it's something where you would say to yourself, I'd like to find out more. On the other hand, there could be somebody who gives off negative vibes and you feel uncomfortable and there's something antagonistic about him. In that case, well, let it go. You're not obligated. So this is not emotions as evidence, but simply emotions as what Lee Pearson calls inklings. And there are times when there's nothing at stake and there's no reason not to say, I just don't care for that person, and not to engage.
The other parts of his answer were excellent. You know, he said that emotions are our main motivators. They get us moving and get us out of bed. Our desires, our anxieties, our emotions are motivators. You know, a gun points at me, I have fear to do something about it. If a reward is out there for me and I can get it, I'm going to take action to get it, and that'll motivate me. It's my way of enjoying life. I wouldn't enjoy success if I didn't have this. But you know, he brings up here a third point, which is really, it's not just the negative part, like he said about the gun example, it's positive inklings. And we've said this before on our podcasts here, never ignore your gut. No, it's not the final answer. When you have time to think it through, introspect. That's going to be the other theme here, I think, today. Introspect. Ask yourself what that means, understand it, understand your emotion. When you're comfortable with your emotions, though, when you're confident that your emotions are aligned with objective values and your objective evaluations, then you can act on them. And there are many situations we just don't have time to. But there are also moments, like he points out here, you see something or you meet someone and you just get a gut feeling, an inkling, hey, that's interesting. That might be really positive. And so you pursue that person. Now, again, it's just an inkling. It may be wrong. As you find out more, you might find out why you got that inkling and how it was a misimpression, or why you got that inkling and why it was true and why the person turned out to be good. I know Dr. Peikoff says he was disappointed repeatedly on this score, and I have been too, because first impressions don't necessarily, or inkling or a gut feeling isn't necessarily reliable, but it's a good indicator to say, you know, we talk about red flags in relationships. There are some really bright green flags in relationships. Don't ignore those bright green flags in relationships either. But emotions as such are just automatic responses, as we know as objectivists, automatized evaluations built into our subconscious, built into, in effect, our bodies. And so we can't ignore them, because they are given automatized emotions. And they, if we are confident that our values are lined up with them, then they are never, ever to be ignored. Even in cases where we turn out to be mistaken, that woman really seemed interesting. She seemed beautiful and charming and interesting and intelligent. And then it turns out, no, she didn't. That inkling itself was not necessarily wrong. There were, in fact, you could find yourself saying a lot of those values were correct. It's just that it turned out that I was mistaken. There was something deeper, more, or it turned out, yeah, she actually fulfilled that. Never ignore those, even if they're not necessarily our tool of cognition and our final means of judging the person or the situation.
Yes, yes. I would say emotions aren't reason, but they are reasons to start reasoning.
Yes, exactly. That's very clever.
But you're right. You mentioned, you know, jumping to the end of the process here, as Leonard Peikoff says. Another thing among many is that if there were no emotions, you could have no enjoyment of life. Satisfaction, fulfillment, all of that involves happiness, feeling good, enjoyment, pleasure, and the like. Unquote, we say as objectivists, you know, happiness is the result of living a rational, successful life. Why live a rational, successful life if you have no payoff, if you have no reason to do it? So yes, yes, I would definitely say when somebody says, well, why do we have emotions? There's almost too many answers to that.
Right.
But it is the I don't want to say the payoff because that would be emotionalism. It is the reason for reason. So let me go to question number two, because now we get into, well, what does that look like in a real life, a real person? And Leonard Peikoff has asked on his podcasts, an earlier question, 2009, Ayn Rand said in Atlas Shrugged that courage is the virtue of being true to existence and confidence is being true to one's own consciousness. How do you justify this? So somebody's looking for a little more explanation of that. It's one of my favorite Ayn Rand observations, courage and confidence. Sometimes folks get into this idea that there are only seven virtues. Well, there are seven primary virtues through which most of virtuous action can be understood. But no, there aren't only seven virtues. And I love that we have what you would almost call applications of virtue, but virtues in themselves, courage and confidence. So Leonard Peikoff answers, how do you justify this?
And Ayn Rand did not mean her list of primary virtues to be necessarily exclusive. She's giving primary ones, the principal ones that she could see came from reason. But she's not telling us that this is the entire list of human virtues. That's important to bear in mind. These are the most fundamental ones, as far as she can see. But she never meant that to be the sum total list of all human possible human virtues.
Yes. And it is amazing how well those seven hold up. And as we come across other virtues in life,
it's incredible how they encompass the whole of actual virtue from what I can see. So if someone has something to add to it, I'd be interested. But to me, they seem like the fundamental ones. Yeah.
Yeah. And if folks have copies of the journals of Ayn Rand, the letters of Ayn Rand, even on the fiction side, the early Ayn Rand, you can watch her development. Early on, for example, she spoke of philosophy as having four branches and didn't include aesthetics in that. And of course, she understood the value of aesthetics and eventually codified it as one of the five branches of philosophy. So yes, seven virtues, but courage, confidence, love this. And the questioner says, well, how do you justify this? And Leonard Peikoff says, well, courage, I take to mean that there is a potential loss of a major value confronting you. You feel some fear or apprehension because you value what you value is so important, but you are committed to it. So it is so important that you will act in reality, regardless of your inner state. You will act in reality, regardless of your inner state. In courage, then, you're focused on the value in reality, not in your inner state. That's why she says it's being true to existence. Let me stop the quote there for a second. I have to admit, when I saw this question, I thought, no, that's pretty straightforward and pretty obvious. What else does Dr. Peikoff have to say? But I think he does a great job of saying, well, this is why she says true to existence. Your inner state may or may not be telling you, I'm up for this. I'm ready for this. I can take this risk. I want this so bad. But if the focus is on existence, on what out there you want, what you're seeking to accomplish, that is courage. So Leonard Peikoff goes on real quick. Confidence, on the other hand, is your belief in your own conclusions, the operation of your own mind, as against self-doubt and who am I to know? So you're saying, no matter what the external pressure, I am true to the content and conclusions of my consciousness. It's in that sense that you are being true to your own consciousness. Now, of course, courage and confidence imply each other. I don't think you can have one without the other, but they are different aspects. Being confident of your conclusions and therefore of your values is the necessity of being prepared to be courageous in fighting for them, unquote Leonard Peikoff. Again, another question where I read it and I thought, well, that one's obvious and we all know that. And then Dr. Peikoff gives us the insights to say, well, here's what you might not have realized here. So what did you think of that one?
Well, you know something, emotions, we were just talking about the role, an important role of emotions, and say the emotion of fear, which is the generally regarded as the opposite of courage. Let's take that. Fear is sometimes the perfectly appropriate emotion. If someone's pointing a gun at my head, it is perfectly appropriate to me for me to feel some fear. There's an objective reason for that fear, that my lack of courage in the context of having a gun pointed at me, or my experience, let me put it this way, my experience of fear is nothing negative and moral against me. I'm doing what I can under the circumstances. Courage really applies to those circumstances where I can do something, where there's something meaningful that I can do. And if I don't get off my tail and do it, yeah, that is a moral failing. That is a lack of virtue. I'm not living up to what I know existence requires of me. It's being true to existence. So when we think about the role of emotions from the first question, and we're talking about it here, we can see that the role of courage is actually to get us, to motivate us, in effect, to get us off our tails to do what we can do about a situation when we can do something about it. You know, with the courage, there's two possibilities. One, you're just the rank coward and you're not living up to what you know. There is action I can take. This is an important value that's under threat. It will take courage for me to do this, whatever it takes. So there's your coward. And then, you know, there's those philosophical cowards, and they don't present it as cowardice at all, but total courage. Take your Stoic or your Buddhist who accepts everything and who doesn't want to get involved in the world and doesn't express the courage. See, you know, that serenity prayer that Ayn Rand so loved, God grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Those Buddhists and Stoics, they're really big on that acceptance part. They think everything is encompassed by that acceptance part. They don't recognize that this courage part is necessary. And so the Buddha famously could let his hometown get wiped out and not care because he's completely indifferent. He's not attached to the world. Well, that's a kind of philosophically inspired cowardice. In my mind, it's a withdrawal from the world in a way that's not necessary. But we have to make that distinction. And absent this distinction, it can't be decided emotionally. Obviously, if I'm absorbed by my fear, that can't be done. This philosophically bad approach is going to paralyze me as well. What is required here is the correct introspection. And an understanding of the context in which we find ourselves to know what the appropriate action to take is. Is this a moment that I just have to accept the reality? You know, sometimes people get diagnosed with cancer. There's nothing you can do. It's just the reality. You go to the doctor, you do the best modern medicine can do for you. But sometimes that's just an unpleasant reality and there's no way around it. But there are many times where we can do something, where it's possible for us to take action, and it's important for us to take action. That's where courage kicks in, where we have to be true to existence. And it's that distinction, the very distinction we're talking about. Is it something I can act upon in which case I have a moral responsibility to act on it for my own sake. Is it something that is simply beyond my control or just not worth it to me to fix? Well, then I accept it. I accept it as the metaphysical reality. And here, the words that we're going to get into next, things like regret and hope, those are sloppy words that people really haven't properly distinguished. And it's this very distinction that people are slopping across when they use hope in an equivocal way or regret in an equivocal way, as I think we're about to see.
Yes. And I've got to say, a recent insight that I've had is that courage and confidence, but especially courage, yeah, it can be motivating if you're facing something really, really hard and with a substantial amount of risk or danger. But I'm realizing that it can also apply to simple things that you want to do that are consistent with your values, things you should do, but that you're not motivated to do. And I'm realizing that, for example, before this year's rock and roll picnic, I threw a picnic. I provide all the gear, PA and amplifiers and guitars, and it's really hard. It's a lot of equipment to put together a rock and roll picnic at a park with all the gear to do a full stage setup. And I wasn't motivated to do it. And I think, well, if I have the confidence, though, to know I can do it and do it well, and the courage to say this might leave me very achy afterwards, and all the reasons why every year I think maybe I should downsize it.
Well, you're a one-man roadie. My God, that's a lot of work.
Now, it's easy to say, well, but if you were honest, you would do this, or if you had integrity, you would do that. But that's another reason why I love these what I consider even more virtues of application, like courage and confidence, because if I'm feeling lazy about I need to finish painting my house, well, but what I'm feeling is that I'm not sure I'll be motivated. I'm not sure that I'll have the energy. I'm not sure that it's worth the effort. You can apply courage to that as well. I'm willing to face my own resistance. I'm willing to face my own sense that maybe I'll be disappointed afterward and it won't be as good as I thought. I have the confidence to. So I love that Dr. Peikoff addresses these virtues and that Ayn Rand said that in Atlas Shrugged. It's so good. I also love that there's a Heinlein quote about courage. He says, courage, because you mentioned this, James, courage is the complement of fear. A man who is fearless cannot be courageous. He's also a fool. Now, it depends on what you mean by courage. It depends on how you take the words to mean. And I know people who say, no fear, I'm not going to feel any fear. But at that point, they are feeling fear. They're simply steeling themselves against it, if they're rational. So I love that quote from Heinlein. If you really have no fear, then there is no courage.
There is no courage. And there's nothing, in other words, and when we feel fear, we have to really make a rational assessment about how we react. And the courage is that rational assessment. You're not going to act in a foolhardy way. You're not going to throw your life away, take unnecessary risks or anything. On the other hand, you're going to take the action that seems rationally necessary and appropriate given the situation. And part of courage is exactly finding that line. Where is it that I can make the difference? Where is it that I should make the difference? Because if it's not, then we're back at that point of, look, there's nothing I can do. I accept it. It's outside of my control. But right. To the extent that it is a value of yours, to the extent that it is in your control, that's when morality kicks in. Right. That's when you say to yourself, what am I doing about it?
Yes. That's why I love the collection Keeping It Real, because I want to see, well, myself and everyone out there apply these concepts to your life. It's so easy to think, well, I'd be courageous if I ever had to confront IRS representative or an Iranian dictator, or, you know, some extreme that we do need people to be courageous about, but we need to be willing to be that in our own lives. I will be courageous enough to go out and find the job that I want, to ask this girl out on a date, to paint my house, even though I hate house painting and I'm not sure it's going to look great. Do the things in real life. It's so easy to say, well, courage is about great things, and I would do great things if I ever had to confront great things.
To leave that abusive relationship, to take on the ambitious new job that you always wanted to do, those kind of things in life often take great courage to walk up to that girl you've always been fascinated by and to ask her out for a cup of coffee. You know, these things in life can make a huge difference to our happiness. And,
yes,
and understanding courage and applying courage in the correct moment and saying, no, 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 this value is so important to me. And the downside of her saying no is compare. I know it. It's her. She says no, it's going to be, I'm going to be crushed. I'm not going to have a happy night tonight if she says no. On the other hand, how do I ever get the yes if I don't walk up and try? And yeah, courage is absolutely vital in life because it understands the role of volition. But objectivism is unique because it doesn't regard volition as a magical property. It is only certain circumstances that we have control over, and we only have certain degree of control over it. But to the degree that we do, the degree to which we can take action that'll make a difference, the degree to which our volition is operative, we really should. That's where morale, as I say, that's the province of morality. And to get the most out of life and to avoid the bad stuff in life, we have to be aware of just these issues. That's the power of morality.
Yes, you know, we will regret far more the things we never did than the things we tried and failed. And that leads us to question number three. Can a rational person have regrets? You know, if you're fully rational, how can you possibly regret anything? You always made the rational choice. Anyway, back to the question. Can a rational person have regrets? And if so, how do you get past such regrets? Sounded like a simple question until he added that on. And Leonard Peikoff has a lot to say about it. Let me read the beginning of his answer to start us off. Leonard Peikoff says, quote, yeah, certainly a rational person can have regrets. Obviously, if what he's done in the past is immoral, even if he's rational now, he still has to say, well, I'm sorry I did this. I wish that I hadn't done this. I feel regret about it. If he were to say, well, yes, I did those awful things, but what the hell? I'm rational now, so let's just forget what I did in reality. Well, he would be evading a huge amount of things and the appropriate evaluation of them. Even if he wouldn't do them tomorrow, he did them yesterday. And even further, though, suppose you are 100% honest, but through an error of knowledge, a very bad consequence occurs. For instance, you did everything you could to find out when an exam was scheduled at school, but you were given the wrong date. And you didn't show up, resulting in bad consequences from the teacher. You didn't do anything wrong, but you certainly would have to say, well, I regret that I missed that test because it caused me a big hassle, a makeup exam, and all the rest. That's not a regret about character flaws, but it's a great regret about a value that, even though honestly, you lost. You can't want something, act some way, and then say, well, I'm indifferent to the fact that I didn't get it. And that's the first part. Let me give a bit of the second part of his answer here. You say, well, how do you get past your regrets? Depends on what you did. Some regrets you can't get past because they're mortal sins, capital crimes, let's say. But assuming that it can in some way be made up for, well, you should do what's possible to correct it. If it's an error of knowledge, then there's nothing you can do unless you realize that you were counting on something that was wrong. Well, then you try to correct whatever method might have been wrong. If it was an immoral past, then, well, of course, you have to check thought and action. What was your method of mental functioning that permitted this immorality? And what kind of action can you take to recompense the victims, if any? This is the only way. In other words, you have to pay back as much as possible what you got immorally and change yourself to the extent that you will not be able to do that kind of thing again. That's the only way you can get past your regrets. There's one more paragraph, but I've got to say, when we've talked about forgiveness, when forgiveness is rational versus when it is irrational and unjust, that's exactly the case that Leonard Peikoff just laid out there.
It applies to you. It applies to forgiving yourself. You know, we talk about forgiving people. Well, regret can be that. So when we talk about forgiving other people, never forget the most important, the only character you can shape, the most important character for you to be evaluating at all times, 24/7, is your own. And sometimes when we do good things, don't fail to pat yourself on the back. Hey, I worked hard. I did something really smart there. I planned ahead. Yay, I did something virtuous, and give yourself the credit for doing the virtuous thing. On the other hand, if you do something bad, we also have to evaluate ourselves in that way. Now, don't lose context here. The word regret, it's like when people say, I'm sorry. You know, I can go to a funeral where I had nothing to do with the person's illness or death, and I'll say to the widow, I'm sorry, because I truly do feel bad that this happened, even though I was no part of the causal agency that made it happen.
Yes.
In fact, his death may have been inevitable. On the other hand, if I did something wrong, immoral, that I could have done otherwise, I knew better and I didn't do the correct thing. Well, now it's a different kind of regret altogether. See, we use the same word regret to mean multiple different things. Mm-hmm. Regret can mean, on one end, I was disappointed. I was disappointed by something that I wanted to be the case, but I didn't really have control over it, or it wasn't so important to me that I took action that was meaningful, that was worth it to me to do it. I'm still nonetheless disappointed in the outcome. And it can be all the way from the sadness about someone dying, or some modest, and that's the other thing people have to bear in mind, there are differences in degree here, to some mild disappointment. I'm sorry that didn't work out, that we couldn't meet yesterday for coffee. You know, well, let's reschedule it to Thursday. Okay, that's a modest regret. But the point is, there are differences in degree, but more importantly, there are differences in kind in regret. And the other thing is that morality has not, philosophy has failed us on this regard when it comes to volition, when it comes to free will, what you are and are not really in control of. Christianity loads us with all of these unearned guilts. All, you're born in sin, say a bunch of Christians. You can't help, but every day passes, but you sin because lust is already a sin, anger is already a sin. And so they load us down, and with all of these impossible altruistic social duties too. And no one can live up to half of it. You know, it'd be madness in any case. So Christianity loads you up with feeling guilt about your nature, your emotional nature. You can't be anything but a sinner. You're depraved by your nature. When if a religion or some Neoplatonic philosopher or some Kantian duty guy comes along on you and imposes all these unearned guilts on you, then what you have to back up and say, no, wait a minute, that was not within my volitional control. That is not a question of morality. I did the best I could. And, you know, there's that on the one hand, regrets, guilt, which is very different than the I'm disappointed, I'm sorry, I wish things had been otherwise. I can't control, you know, every factor in the universe. Nonetheless, I'm still sad at certain outcomes. And, you know, these determinists who are not religious, they don't provide any other better alternative to this, do they? Or these emotionalist subjectivists, they don't provide any alternative, do they, either? They're not telling you when the guilt has been earned and when the regret is simply, I'm sorry about something that I really couldn't control. So we've, with the word regret, what we've done is we've slopped out in many cases and made ambiguous the distinction here that volition really is critical about here. There are regrets and there are regrets. And when we can identify something as really, I should have done something different. It was something I could have done something different. We have to distinguish between an error of knowledge. Gee, I didn't know. Don't beat yourself up for an error of knowledge. Don't blame yourself for not knowing what you didn't know when you didn't know it and you really had no reason to know it. So why are you kicking yourself for not knowing that? And like I say, there are degrees of it. That was a little negligent on my part, but I can make up for it. I'll do it 10 times better for you next time. It's something you can fix. It's a fixable regret, even if it was a poor choice on your part. So there's differences in degree here. But he's right. If it is a guilt, you have to take action. If it's something you could have, should have, and could have known better about, it is incumbent upon you to change your character so that you don't let that happen again, to make restitution when that is possible, to really acknowledge your wrongdoing to the victim. All of those are essential, in my view, to earn, as we say, forgiveness. And let's face it, ladies and gentlemen, the moral judgment we make about ourselves is the most important moral judgment we're going to make about anyone.
Well said. Not sure I could add anything to that, other than if you've read the essay, The Metaphysical and the Man-Made, if you've made that distinction between that which simply is and that which can be judged, then it's easy to see why so many of these concepts apply to both the metaphysical and the man-made. When we say, I'm sorry, we're not always apologizing. We're sometimes simply expressing sorrow. I have empathy. I have sympathy. I understand. You mentioned a funeral. The difference would be if you go to a funeral and you say, I'm sorry your father passed away versus I apologize for your father passing away.
And sometimes yes. Language is sloppy about that. And philosophy has not really given us the objective guidance to do that so that we can distinguish regret, the kinds of regret. Gee, I'm just really sorry and disappointed that that happened. Or I am sorry I did that. I'm right. Sorry, I knew better and I should not have done that. Those are two different situations. And philosophy yes. hasn't done a terribly good job, whether religious or the so-called secular, you know, more subjectivist, utilitarian, pragmatic types. They've not, neither side has given us the correct moral guidance so that people don't have carry around this ball and chain of honor and guilt, on the other hand, or this belief that morality is just a myth and anything goes. So I shouldn't feel regret at all. Sometimes that's just the false alternative we're presented with, and that doesn't give us any real guidance.
Yeah, I blame philosophy for that one. I rather like the richness of language, or at least the English language. But philosophy has certain... And in that regard, we've got a super chat from Dr. Ribbons, who I'm looking forward to seeing on the reality show again. She's been off of there for a week or two. I want to see her back on there. Always fun and interesting insights. Anyway, Dr. Ribbons asks, and here's a question for us. Is it irrational to be disappointed when you ask someone out and they turn you down? Well, their unavailability doesn't undermine your accomplishments. So what do you think, James? Is it irrational to be disappointed when you ask someone out? I think you just gave this example, and they turn you down.
No. Of course, disappointment is the appropriate. You were seeking a value and you didn't achieve the value you sought. Anytime that happens, you have a right to feel, gee. Now, the question about whether you should regret what you did is a question of your volitional actions. Was I too reticent? Did I put my foot in it by saying something wrong? And don't, like I say, again, kick yourself over every mistake you might have made. It might have been an error of knowledge, might have been the context. But the point is, judging you, your role in it in terms of regret, look, When I was in my 20s and I approached someone for a date, most of the time I got the answer, no. Did I feel good about that? No, I felt bad about that. But did most of the time I feel any kind of guilt or regret for having at least tried? No. Most of the time I'd say, at least I had the courage. And most of the time I would say, at least I wasn't offensive. I did it correctly, appropriately, without being offensive or too much or too little. The review of our action is quite a different thing than our disappointment that we didn't get a value that we were seeking. It wasn't my fault. It wasn't her fault. She has her own context. She has a right to her own values and boundaries. So I can't blame her, nor if I approached it appropriately, if I handled it appropriately in the context and had the courage to try, I'll give myself some credit. At least I tried. Now, a lot of people in that context will take the rejection as a challenge to their self-esteem so that they, you know, oh, what's wrong with me? Now, if you have a fragile self-esteem, then every disappointment, every time actors go through this all the time, they go on huge casting calls, and 90% of the time, 99% of the time, they get no's because you're just not right for the part. And they have to constantly face no, 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 even if it has nothing to do with anything about them, they were just not right for the part. And yet that is going to wear down a self-esteem to some extent, even in a normal, healthy person who has a good, healthy self-esteem. Is there something that I'm doing that I can improve? This is where it takes the Howard Roark independence. You got to know your worth. You got to know with your judgment what you're doing. If there's something you can improve, if there's something about my approach that I need to work on, you know, is there something off-putting? Is there something about my own character that I need to work on? Actually something about my character that I need to work on that is putting people off wanting to get to know me? All those things are going to factor into this. But my disappointment is perfectly natural, perfectly understandable. Yeah. Say to yourself, yeah, that's really screwed up. I'm sorry that happened. But it wasn't her fault. It wasn't my fault is often the situation. So there's no reason for guilt. There may be a kind of regret. I'm sorry, but there's no reason for any kind of guilt in most of those kind of situations.
Great point. Yeah. And if you find yourself in that position, realize that there are a lot of people who might ask you out who you would just say, well, that's not a person that I want to be with, but there's nothing wrong with them. It's out of those 10 people, you know, those two I would go out with.
So see, yeah, it's more rare, but I've actually been on that end of it too. I'm usually the disappointed, not the disappointer.
But that's the funny thing is we all feel that.
Right.
I'm sure there's a few people out there who are so hot that nobody would ever say no to them.
Exactly. They don't know what I'm talking about.
But even those of us who feel like the numbers are against us, there's a bunch of people I wouldn't go out with. Right. Nothing wrong with them.
And I've painfully had to say no. And that is difficult because you're trying to say it in a way that does divorce it from any moral context because it isn't a moral issue.
Right.
That's we could do a whole show on that. The art of the gentle letdown when it's appropriate to be a gentle letdown. There is an art to it because you have to be direct, honest. You have to be clear about, no, this is not going to work out. That's the only kindness to yourself or indeed to the other person. On the other hand, is there a properly contextual way of doing that by saying, look, it's no moral issue. It's just not going to work out.
as you say, it's an art. I mean, if you're really good at it, you can encourage the other person so much they're ready to ask the next person.
Exactly.
Most people aren't that good at it.
Right.
But great question from Dr. Ribbons. Thank you for that. We also have a super chat from Apollo Zeus, who's in for a couple of pounds and says, Gangsta Paddington will be back soon. Gangsta Paddington is a YouTube user who sometimes shows up in the chat. I wonder if Apollo Zeus has some inside information on that user account. I'm not even going to speculate, although it's better to speculate than never. Let me read the last paragraph of this answer, because Leonard Peikoff also says, I just want to point out, you can't regret your nature. A rational person can't say, well, if only I were omniscient, everything would be great. But I'm really sorry that I'm stuck with this. That would be basically a whole religious attitude. We're caught in this world. Well, they don't mean socially, but metaphysically caught in the physical world. And it's awful. We regret that we were born into it, but the jailbreak into another dimension is coming. Now, that is a metaphysical regret of the nature of reality.
Yeah.
That a rational person can't have, close quote, Leonard Peikoff. It's funny, somebody posted a meme earlier. We've talked about Star Wars a couple of times on the channel. It said, admit it, at least once you've tried to move something with the Force. You know, that I wish over it is.
No, I can't say I've ever tried to move something with the Force or any other kind of magic. Shows you my lack of confidence, I think, in my whole life. The violations of causality could happen. But, you know, the truth is...
Ye of little or no faith.
Okay, I'm guilty as charged. But he makes a great point here. Don't blame yourself for your nature. Don't blame yourself for the given. Don't blame yourself for having good values and what your values are and that they're not consistent with someone else's values. No, have that. And that's where that confidence part kicks in. I'm confident in my own values. And guess what? If the person isn't responding to my values, or if in any sense I'm having a negative response to theirs, you can't condemn yourself either for your innate nature or for you, what you regard as your virtuous nature. And yet religion, again, gets people thinking along those kind of lines, as if it's my fault that anytime someone doesn't like me, respond to me positively, it's somehow there's something wrong with me. That's a self-esteem issue, ladies and gentlemen. And you've got to, there, it requires introspection. There, you've got to ask yourself some questions about yourself and where your doubt, where your lack of confidence and courage is coming from, because it's often rooted in a self-esteem issue. You don't think yourself worthy or able. And that would require addressing, because a healthy self-esteem is part of our toolkit for being able to make this distinction where we understand the role of free will, where, yeah, there was something I could have done and I'm going to correct, or there was nothing I could have done and I'm just sorry for the outcome.
Right. Oh, I don't want to get too far off track, but in the chat, Dr. Ribbon says, well, you can regret a lack of omniscience. I would say the exact opposite is true. If you've ever fantasized about being omniscient in the supposedly religious sense, can you imagine knowing everything everybody thought? That would be the worst thing. And there are things I think that I don't want anybody to know, not just because of privacy, but because it would just be unpleasant. It would be horrifying beyond belief if you were flooded with the knowledge of everything going on out there, including whatever omniscience. No, thank you.
I have to say, omniscience cannot be our standard.
It's not possible, but it's not desirable if it was.
Right. Cut yourself slack, as I say, for not knowing what you didn't know. If there really was, there are things which I should have known, perhaps. It was there, yes, sitting right under my nose. People had been pointing it out to me, poking me on the head, Jim. And then when I don't do it, yeah, okay, I should know. But if you really didn't know, if there really wasn't a good reason for you to have known, why are you kicking yourself for not knowing it? We learn. Not only do we need to, I've said this before, respect other people's learning curves. Here today, I just want us to focus on ourselves. How about our own learning curve? I can regret not knowing something, but that's more like, I'm sorry that the person died. That's the sorry part. That's not a guilt thing. Gosh, I just didn't know. I better check that out. And if I'm taking the correct moral action to figure out what I think I needed to know, then I'm doing the moral thing. I've corrected for that error of knowledge, and now I'm learning, and I'm going to build that in, and I'm going to habituate it if it's a necessary part of my character. Now I've done the correct steps to build that in and to correct for that ignorance. But it was just ignorance, not a moral issue.
Right. Now they're talking about this in the chat. For example, there was a television episode, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where she could read other people's minds. You don't even have to go that far. Just watch the film written by, I think co-written by, ARC UK host Paul Gay, Liar, starring Jim Carrey. Example of somebody, you didn't even have to know everything he's thinking. He simply couldn't lie. He couldn't not say what he was thinking.
As a lawyer, I can tell you.
You must have especially appreciated that.
Major
film.
Problems for many lawyers out there if they can't all lie. It's a very amusing movie and a well-written screenplay by our friend. Yeah.
Yeah, that really was well done. Yes, I always say radical honesty is neither. It's not radical and it's not honest. those people who say, well, I'm going to be really honest, so I'm just going to tell everybody what I think all the time. Yeah. That'll give you an idea of what omniscience would look like and why you don't want that person to be your parent. Yes, so let me jump to question number four. We've had a lot of good insights on number three here, but how would you reply to someone who grants? Now, here we're going to get into a moral practical, and this you'll see how this relates. How would you reply to someone who grants that the economy should be free and individual rights absolute, but doubts whether men of flesh, blood, cunning, and force could ever practically create and sustain such a system? You know, we got great ideals, but what are we to do with men such as us? And let me read the beginning of Dr. Peacock's answer here.
It's not good enough to live up to it.
What's good about your ideals if they're not achievable? Then they're not ideals.
Right.
So obviously we're basing our ideals on something different than the idea of men as flesh, blood, cunning, and force. Leonard Peacock says, this question rests on a metaphysical view of man, of what his inherent attributes are and how he will have to function. Well, first of all, it includes flesh and blood as one of those things that are a source of human corruption. In other words, the pure good, the real good, would be if man did not have a body. If he were a pure soul, you know, then maybe he could be one of those omniscient people we're talking about in the chat.
Right, right.
The physical weighs him down and leads to evil. That is a purely religious premise. It is a mystical, supernaturalist approach to make flesh and blood, in other words, the physical, responsible for evil. Objectivism rejects any form of religion or supernaturalism out of hand. The questioner also mentions cunning. Well, I assume this means cunning in the sense of fraud. It's very simple. I'm sure you must know all kinds of honest, non-cunning, in that sense, people. I certainly do. There's no reason in the world to believe that fraud, the passion for fraud, is going to interfere with a capitalist system, particularly since fraud is one of the things that the government is out to prevent and punish and remove from society. Force is the same thing. Force is that which is wielded by criminals. It is certainly not inherent in the nature of man. The distinction between the man and the beast is reason versus force. And if a man chooses to use force in a proper capitalist system, he is then treated as an animal and incarcerated or fined. So all of these alleged attributes that you list are completely based on an original sin view of man. He's doomed to evil, dishonesty, and force, presumably because he's got a physical body. It's an out-and-out religious viewpoint. I couldn't agree more, but I run into that left and right. Yaron Brook just did a debate with Brian Kaplan on anarcho-capitalism. The same question comes up. Well, you know, people are going to do evil things. Government can't fix that, so you've just got to accept it. And weighs on that idea that, yeah, we're really, there's so much corruption, so much evil, that the good, huh?
You know, if I were going to go by history, and I am a historian, and I were to look at this, and I were to take, say, a caveman from 40,000 years ago, and I were to say, well, could this guy, you know, just pluck him from his state of nature and his historical context and put him in ours? Could he function on our society? Would there be all kinds of problems? Well, sure, of course there would be. He hasn't had the intellectual and moral development the humans have actually engaged in over the last several thousand years, then it wouldn't be available to him. Could he be educated? Could he be, all that? Absolutely. Now, on the other hand, look at recent history. Today, most people are horrified, moral, civilized people, at the institution, say, of slavery. But, you know, that's only been a reality in the last couple hundred years. Before the last couple, 200 or 300 years, slavery was the norm everywhere. Everyone accepted it as normal, natural, inevitable. Even if they had certain, you know, distaste for it, they just accepted it. Today, we demand that there be no civilized nation that allows slavery. That kind of moral improvement in our knowledge, our ethical knowledge, is possible. Humans have done that. We've changed. If I were to view, say, today's I don't mean to be ripping on people today because I don't think it's a matter of human nature. But if I were to look at, you know, people today versus, say, 60 years ago in the United States, yeah, there's been a decline. Part of that decline has been a question of our philosophy, our culture, and so forth. Part of it has been the volition of the people involved. But again, it's a curious thing because it's two really different questions here that people slop into one question. It's sort of almost a package deal that we're asked to deal with here. I know of no other way to put it, other than the fact that human beings need to learn to introspect, need to introspect about these differences. They need to learn to distinguish what is volitionally within their control and what is not. They cannot condemn themselves for their nature. It would be insane for me to condemn myself for my nature. But you know, those changes that I was talking about are not built into human nature. We're capable of being the most incredible heroes. We can be geniuses like Isaac Newton or Ayn Rand or Aristotle. We can be creative artists. We can be heroes of the greatest courage, people who take the risk of landing on the moon. We also have a volition, and the same faculty of volition allows us to do the most horrific things. This very same faculty of volition that permits us to be so creative in our minds that we can hit golf balls on the moon also allows us to be the most self-destructive, potentially, of all the organisms on that. We can act as intentionally as our own destroyers, unlike other animals. We can engage in things like the Nazi concentration camps, slaughtering millions of innocent civilians, engaging in medical experiments on children, the most horrific things you can imagine. So we are capable. That is the nature of volition. And volition has that entire range, ladies and gentlemen. It has that entire range. Appreciate individual context, appreciate historical context where you're coming from, but distinguish critically between what you could have done something about and what you couldn't have done something about. That is where morality and philosophy have utterly failed us and have left human beings with all kinds of psychological confusion. And that's really what I kind of wanted to focus on in these questions today.
You know, it's interesting. Leonard Peikoff, in one of his discussions, was asked during the Q&A about Karl Popper, falsifiability and Kuhn shifting paradigms. And, you know, can you actually achieve certainty if science is, what did they call it, a history of exploded fallacies? And he made the point that those supposed exploded fallacies, the whole idea of shifting paradigms or of falsifiability, none of those make sense unless you actually have a standard, something, you have a definition of certainty, and certainty is not possible, then neither are any of those so-called paradigms. And I see the same thing in ethics. And this is an insight I got listening to Leonard Peikoff talk about knowledge. I thought, well, on the ethical side, the same thing is true. The people who say, well, people are fundamentally corrupt, makes no sense unless virtue is even more fundamental and virtue is possible. And I don't see any other explanation for the world of technology and manufacturing and computers and art and science and sports and everything else in the world. I don't see any explanation for everything that's around us if you say, well, there's so much bad, there's so much evil, that the good obviously just hasn't got a chance.
What a horrible contradiction. You are, without your control, outside of your control, by your nature, innately corrupt, which is a moral evaluation, which assumes volition. How can I, without any choice or control on my part, without any decision-making at all on my part, be in any way corrupt? It cannot be. If it's outside of my realm of control, look, in an ideal objectivist world, going back to the Jerome Brooke argument, people will still have volition. Anarchists have to understand people will have volition. You can't. There are some voluntarist anarchists of the 20th century who believe that human moral improvement will become such that government will wither away on its own because people will become so good that, no, people will always have free will. Now, I think moral improvement is possible. I think as people do become better philosophically educated, more introspective about their own emotions, I think that the general quality of people's moral characters and by the way, psychological health can improve over time. So I expect an objectivist world will see dramatic improvements that way, but we'll always still have free will. And that's what we have to take into account. And if we have a government which does stop force and fraud, then we're accounting for that aspect of human nature, free will. Not the inherent corruption of mankind or the innate depravity of humanity. Not at all. If we thought that humans were innately depraved, well, my libertarian anarchist friends, then that would be a much better justification for like Hobbes' Leviathan state or Marx's dictatorship of the proletariat.
Yes. Let me just give the last paragraph here of Leonard Peikoff's answer, because here's one we could do a whole show on too. Leonard Peikoff says, I just want to add that men did in fact establish a system of freedom and absolute rights with the founding of this country. And it did work. It lasted for quite a while, almost a century. And what brought it to an end was not the corruption of human nature, but the wrong philosophy, unquote Leonard Peikoff. Now, I would say it lasted for more than 100 years, but he's right. Those first 100 years of actually following those principles and then constant improvement throughout the first 100 years, especially with the Industrial Revolution and the abolition of slavery, magnificent. But I would say that even the 100 years after that, where we're at today, this is still in many measurable ways the greatest country in the world. And we've fallen so far, but that just tells us what we could be and what we can work to be.
The improvements in humanity over the last 200 or 300 years have been unprecedented in the whole of human existence on this planet. Our species has been around for, what, 150, 200,000 years on this planet? And just in the last couple of centuries, the leaps that we have made socially, morally, scientifically, technologically are real. I mean, there's absolutely no reason to get all depressed about human nature. Quite the opposite. Quite the opposite. Even if you see our culture going to hell in a handbasket, I know as a student of history that humans are capable of better. People are not controlled by their lust for power or their need to engage in force, and their bodies are not the source of that. Our minds control our behavior, ladies and gentlemen. They shape our values. They shape our emotions. Humans are capable of much better, even than what you see around you today. Don't judge human nature based on the particular examples you see around you personally or in your own time. Look at the broader picture of history. And as you say, we are still benefiting. Even though things aren't what they were, we're still benefiting from that glorious moment, that explosion of reason and freedom that we call the Enlightenment Industrial Revolution. It doesn't help, of course, to have all intellectuals denouncing the most glorious thing that ever happened in human history as an evil thing. Yes. But it truly should be inspirational to us. Humans are capable of magnificence, just as they're capable of force and fraud. And it's not built into their flesh, ladies and gentlemen, whatever the Christians tell you, whatever the so-called secular determinists tell you, humans are capable of improvement through their reason.
Just so. Now, your comments and this last question give us a lot toward the answer to the final fifth question, which I'm thinking, and I'll ask you if you agree, that we should probably delay a week because we could do a whole show on this. I'll read the question to give folks an idea of what I'm saying here. Leonard Peikoff was asked, well, where can a young person desperate over the state of the world and with no heroes find hope and solace? Leonard Peikoff will talk about the idea of hope. He will talk about the idea of solace, but there's so much more to this that, James, I know you've got a lot to say about this, and you know from me that I've got a lot to say about this. It's okay with you. I'd like to put this one off. We kind of answered the question already with the previous four, and I hope folks got a lot out of that. We just got a super chat in from Jeff Bannister, a very, very generous and appreciated supporter of the ARC UK. And he says, while I'm steering my own ship, sometimes I lose the wind behind me. How can you overcome those lulls that come up from time to time? Well, I think Jeff is asking the same question this questioner does. And it's a long answer Dr. Peikoff gives. I would encourage folks, if you've got a copy of Keeping It Real, take a look at the question on page 220. I don't want to leave Jeff hanging, but if you missed the beginning of this episode and didn't watch it through, you might want to do that. And there's more coming up real quick on the Ayn Rand Center UK in a half an hour, which is probably why we need to wrap up ASAP. But this is going to be good. Thomas Bisson is on with Nico Satyrakopoulos. How's that for a combination? Yeah. And they're going to be talking about the idea of essentialism. Yeah, you know, that we all need to cut back on the superfluous stuff on our lives and focus on what really matters. The title is Should You Pursue Less? Well, when you put it that way, obviously not. But I know they're going to have a great
presentation. There's that whole Marie Kondo thing, right? That minimalist thing. Get rid of all the stuff you don't need, the things
that's
you don't
exactly
need.
Exactly.
So how efficient is a good life?
And I think there's obviously there's going to be a great way to take that. There are some ideas in which it's fraught. That's right. Going to be a great discussion. Coming up at 6 o'clock or 1 o'clock Eastern time, we're going to be talking about a few things, but the United Nations. a platform for all dictators. That's going to be a good discussion. I'm actually going to be on the panel for that one at 6 p.m. So for the reality show, join us for that. And also, as if that's not enough already, Dr. Lee Pearson, who I mentioned earlier in the show, the topic on the cutting edge this week is, what is gender? And there's a special guest. Ray Shelton's going to be on to talk with Dr. Lee and the other members. There's usually a whole panel on Dr. Lee's show to talk about what the hell is gender anyway. That's going to be a good discussion. We've got another question. James, I feel like we could go on until the bottom of the hour here.
But do you see, folks, the integration that we're bringing across and discussing some of these issues, you know, revisiting them, coming back around? First of all, there are areas where objectivism has these profound answers and a unique position to give on these questions of the day. Moreover, you can see where the cutting edge of objectivist knowledge is, and even hear disagreements at the margins between objectivists. Absolutely. All of that. And if you think that creating an international group of serious students of objectivism, addressing the issues, in fact, every issue under the sun and applying objectivism to it is important, let me, please, my friends, I urge you to consider becoming a paid subscriber to the Ayn Rand Center UK. If you regard these discussions as valuable as I think they are, and if you think they can make a difference to the world, please subscribe at whatever level you're comfortable with. Hit like, share, subscribe, leave comments, but also consider becoming a paid subscriber. You'll get all kinds of extra perks. And I think we're doing some of the most important work in the world here. If you agree, please do consider becoming a subscriber.
Yes. And folks in the chat do agree, because again, Jeff Bannister is in with a generous super chat. Jeff, again, we don't have too much time to give you a complete answer, but when you say, while I'm steering my own ship, sometimes I lose the wind behind me, how do you overcome those lulls that come up from time to time? As James has pointed out, you can focus a lot on what you're fighting, or you can focus on what you're fighting for. And the way to turn that around in your case is, well, I talk about fighting evil and I'm fighting for the good. You can do that internally too. It's very easy for me to focus on what are my roadblocks, what are my challenges, what are the things getting me down and sapping my motivation. And I have to do the same thing with myself, turn it around and say, okay, but what am I fighting for, even in my own personal life, even in my own goals, my own motivation, my own desires, achieving my own values?
Jeff, distinguish between the wind, which you can't control in your sails, and your steering of the ship. If you're steering the ship the best you can, if you're tacking, you got those sails and you're tacking the best you can, give yourself the full-on credit for that and understand that sometimes the wind is outside of our control. Now, I understand that we use reason and we have this tacking skill so that we can, in fact, overcome. We can go against the wind, in effect, as we're sailing our sailboats if we use our reason properly. But don't blame yourself for knowledge you don't have. But try and figure out the way to use the wind as best you can. Don't kick yourself for not being omniscient about the wind. Appreciate that the wind is outside of your control. But reason is the way to help us master controlling the wind. And as Robert says, we're going to have, I think, some additional insights into that question next time. I think the whole topic of perfection and what is and is not in our control is worthy of an entire episode. So do join us next week as Robert and I explore the question of perfection. And Jeff, I suspect you're more perfect than you probably give yourself credit for. And it may have something to do with whether or not you're judging yourself at the rudder and, you know, and at the till, as opposed to blaming yourself for the wind.
Wow. Couldn't have said it better myself. We have one more super chat. I've got to say thanks to Apollo Zeus, who's in for £5 and says, how much courage is required in science and truthfulness in that field? Another big question. I'm sure we don't have time to answer right now. Maybe we'll spend some time with that next week, but
real quick,
as much courage as is required anywhere.
Just ask Galileo. Just ask Giordano Bruno. Just ask the men who gave their lives for science, for some scientific, for believing something different, for just even if they were wrong, men who gave their lives for believing, for going by their own judgment and truth. It can take enormous courage if you live in a society that is anti-reason and does not allow the freedom to express and act on your best judgment. So in those kind of situations, it takes, and even in outside of those kind of, even in a free society, the social pressures that you might get in a bad culture, it takes courage to stand up for the truth. It absolutely does. It's connected to confidence because it's confidence in your own consciousness, but courage, taking the actions based on it, absolutely, absolutely. Science is, some of the greatest heroes in history have been scientists. Yes, yes, sir.
I'm glad you brought the history into that, James, because you're right. Being canceled used to be even worse than it is now.
There's canceling, and of course, there's burning at the stake, you know.
Yes. Excellent. Well, James, thank you. Thank you for your insights. Another one of those episodes where right afterward, I have to listen to it all over again. So many good points that you've made. Thank you to the folks in the chat. Thank you for the many super chats that we had this time. I always appreciate seeing that. Your support for the Ayn Rand Center UK. We will take question number 5, I think, as a jumping off point for next week. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Keeping It Real. Stay on the Ayn Rand Center UK YouTube channel for the Daily Objective coming up in less than half an hour and the reality show coming up at the top of the hour. James, thank you for another outstanding conversation. We're keeping it real.
Yeah, thank you.